I'm Christopher Lydon in New Delhi with the ringleader of India's emerging online journalism. Tarun Tejpal is a reporter, a novelist, and he's the editor of the weekly magazine Tehelka. It's digital and it's print. It's in Hindi as well as in English. It is very literary. It is very political. It's provocative in both areas, and it's still a high-risk venture. I want you to talk, just for starters, about David Cameron, Prime Minister of England, here in India, hat in hand to a burgeoning economy which owns Jaguar, which could buy British Petroleum, almost exactly 400 years after the East India Company arrived in a weakened India. Have we come full circle, Tarun?
Well, I suppose it would be poetic justice for us to now colonize England for the next 300 years. They did it to us for 300 years. You know, so if you're buying all of UK, I think it's all right. It's a good historical process. I think it's just we're in the midst of a historical process. I think the great subcontinental efflorescence, the great Indian efflorescence, took place 2,000, 1,500 years ago. And then there's been a long period of decline. And if we are and China is, exhibiting a new kind of efflorescence, I think it's inevitable. It's the cycle of history. And I think England is finally on the wrong side of history. It's been on the right side for too many years. You know, it's inevitable that it should now kind of fall off the map a little. Yeah, I think it's all right. I mean, it's a good case for hubris. I mean, it's time. I mean, they've done a lot of good things and wreaked a lot of havoc around the world. It's fair that their time is up. I mean, clearly their time is up. So David Cameron, hat in hand in India, it's fair enough. I as you said, when Thomas Rowe came to Jahangir's court 400 years ago, he came hat in hand, wanting just trading rights. You know, we gave them Jahangir gave them trading rights, and they pretty much ran the continent for 300 years. I think the time is up. You know, I think it's okay. We shouldn't worry about these things.
Give us an instant 100-year history, or maybe 50-year post-World War II history of India and the United States in the world. I'd love to hear a smart Indian's perspective on what we've been up to, what we've done and undone.
I think there what we are seeing is also another kind of instance of someone's time being up. I think it's really time that someone blew the whistle on America and its pretensions. You know, the pretensions of kind of being upholders of democracy around the world has actually, it's about time it came unstuck. You know, I mean, it has so much to pay for. When you read, which unfortunately, because America ends up also controlling so much of mainline media, and it's the only kind of media we consume. In fact, I mean, my great fantasy project, which I hope I can pull off one day, is to actually get an alternative history of the world written of the last 100 years. I mean, you only get one kind of history, which is the Anglo-Saxon view of the world. You know, the Anglo-Saxon view of the world seems to kind of paint everything that the Anglo-Saxon has done in terms of heroic, you know, redemptions and heroic rescues. Whereas when you break it down, you look at Latin America, you look at the history of Latin America in the 1970s. I mean, here was the CIA destabilizing every single movement towards democracy that was taking place because it didn't suit the American interest. I mean, America has constantly gone around the world creating havoc in its foreign policy, while Wilson maintains a degree of a very virile democracy at home. And one salutes that internal virile democracy. And people around the world are attracted to that virile democracy. They go there, they make careers. I mean, Barack Obama could not have happened in most countries in the world. Barack Obama could not happen in India, for that matter, you know, even because we are also far more feudal in that sense than America is. So that's the beauty of internal America. But when you look at America outside its own borders, it's a ghoulish story. I mean, these guys have gone around the world creating trouble. I mean, look at our subcontinent itself. Look at the interventions in Pakistan and Afghanistan over the last 30, 40 years. Today, when I was a young man, you know, and still in school, I used to have a real problem with Mrs. Indira Gandhi, Jawaharlal Nehru's daughter, who was the Prime Minister of India in the 1970s. Sure. And one of the famous things that Indira Gandhi used to often refer to was the foreign hand. You know, it was a bit of a joke. We all grew up as a joke, that this whole idea of the foreign hand, you know, and how the foreign hand could destabilize India. But today, when I look back and I see the kind of declassification of CIA papers, and you read what was happening, you understand that here was a woman in a newly free country, terrified, the daughter of one of the greatest men of the 20th century, Jawaharlal Nehru, terrified at what the American military-industrial machine could do to destabilize the kind of high democracy India had created. So today I have a far more respect for her kind of what then seemed paranoid idea of the foreign hand.
May I say, it's part of the reason we come to India, to hear an independent voice. It's part of the reason we miss the India I grew up with, of Jawaharlal Nehru, non-aligned, independent, smart, global, and his pain-in-the-neck foreign minister, Krishna Menon, always sticking it to the United States, but keeping us honest in a fashion.
I mean, it's very easy to see men of the caliber of Nehru, men of the caliber of Gandhi, men of the caliber of Ambedkar, great, great men. I mean, my hair stand when I talk about these men.
Yes.
I mean, these great men were obviously not going to be faced down by America because it was a rich new country. Even today, I say, in 1950, when we became a republic, the Indian founding fathers did some remarkable things. The two great remarkable things I'll tell you about now, and I'm going to counterpoint them to America. The first thing they did was, they said overnight they gave every adult Indian an equal vote, universal suffrage. Every adult Indian, man, woman, poor, rich, literate, illiterate, was given the same voting right. So overnight we went from being a medieval colonized country to being a modern nation, a modern democratic nation. It's an extraordinary feat of the imagination. You know, the Indian freedom movement, I believe, is the greatest sort of movement of genius of the last 1,000 years because of what it throws up and because of the grounds on which it's built. Grounds that we know later Nelson Mandela was to seize upon, Martin Luther King Jr. was to seize upon, Barack Obama refers to, because they're so seminal. They're such seed ideas that these guys picked on. The second was land reform. Overnight, which Pakistan never did, the Indian founding fathers said nobody would be allowed to own more than a small patch of land, because all these countries were feudal countries where a handful of landowners would own thousands and millions of acres of land, and the rest of the country was peasantry that toiled, you know, for labor on that. So these are the two big things they did overnight. You look at America, even in 1965, you know, Martin Luther King Jr. is struggling against segregation. You know, in 1950, you read all the laws we enacted, there were laws of great, you know, overarching equality. The ideas were in place straight away. So when you're talking about founding fathers of that caliber who put together a constitution that is a truly noble document, that put together the ideas that are soaring ideas of humanity, it was very difficult for them to take the kind of, you know, the elbowing And that America has been used to around the world. So it's one of the reasons why I think we had a slightly dodgy relationship with America. We were also damaged by imperialism. We were damaged by colonialism. It wasn't very easy for us to be very friendly with powers that were obviously imperial and colonial, you know, soon after we became independent. So I think the first 15, 20 years of our relationship were very, very dodgy with America, because we didn't want to be leaned upon. We didn't want to this country run by the diktats of the American CIO, American foreign policy. And I think Nixon and Kissinger's time, it became worse because there was a lot of cozying up with Pakistan happening. They found it much easier to manipulate Pakistan because it remained a feudal country. It remains a feudal country in many levels. There's the elite and the rich, and then there is the very poor. There is no real middle class. And the American relationship with India actually begins to change as more and more Indians come to interact with and engage with what I call internal America. So there is an internal America, yes. and then they discover the kind of virtues and beauty of what is inside America. And there are two ways of looking at it. There is the unofficial America, which Indians, including me, my daughters have studied, as you know,
I've
studied in America. But I didn't study. I didn't want to go there. But by the time my daughters came, they were no longer carrying the wounds that people like me carried. So for them, they didn't want to go to Oxford and Cambridge. When I was in college, my professors wanted me to take the Rhodes Scholarship to go to Oxford because I was also an athlete. So they wanted, but I didn't want to go anywhere. I felt committed to India. I finished my graduation. I started working the next day in journalism. I didn't want to leave India. You know, I mean, I was being set up for this Oxford Scholarship. But even then, our goals of my generation were Oxford, Cambridge. When I suggested that to my daughters, they laughed. You know, they said, "Daddy, you go to the U.S." But I'm saying that's when a generation of Indians had begun to engage with internal America, unofficial America. So unofficial America, I believe, even today, is terrific. I think it's creative. It's energetic. It has great decencies. But official America is problematic. And official America's ugliest face, I think, was the George Bush regime. You know, we saw how ugly official America could be in recent times. I'm sure there are many others. But today, you can also see that can throw up a man like Barack Obama who brings back hope and faith.
And yet the face of America that's fighting a drone war in Afghanistan is not pretty either. Why don't we hear more from India about how problematic, how ugly, how counterproductive that war in Afghanistan has been?
But, you know, you have to understand that India itself is very layered and complex. There is a very wide elite and rich of India, which are very much at home with the kind of right-wing imperialistic notions that America harbors, and would be very happy to see the same unfurled in India, as they are happy to see them being unfurled in India. India itself is no longer the gorgeous land that Gandhi and Nehru dreamt of. India itself is at war within itself. You know, it's again, to use a famous Naipaul phrase, a million mutinies now. India itself is seeing a million mutinies today. It's a country that is at war with itself.
Spell that out.
Well, I mean, the thing is that you have a country today where 10% of Indians, the top rich Indians, own almost 90% of India's resources. You have a country where 700 million Indians, I mean, that's an extraordinary number, still live on less than half a dollar a day, out of which 400 million live on a quarter of a dollar a day. You know, you're talking about half a billion Indians who still don't have access to literacy. You know, I mean, and on the other hand, you have about maybe 10 or 20 or 30 million, or let me not go that far. Let me say you have, in the latest Forbes list of the richest Indians in the world, four of the top 10 are Indians. The richest people, men in the world, four of the top 10 are Indians. So at one level, you have this great, great overarching wealth. In fact, I believe that the rich Indians are among the richest people in the world today. Mm. And then you have this incredible poverty. Now, the idea of India that we always refer to, you know, in discourse within India, which is the idea that was dreamt up by Gandhi and Nehru and those incredible band of men, was an idea that was a great inclusive idea. That idea was presaged on one fundamental notion of building bridges. Because we've always been a country riven by 100 fault lines, caste, class, language, religions. I mean, we have every religion in the world. We have hundreds of languages. We have every ethnicity. You know, we the class differences are huge. I mean, by any reckoning, it makes no sense for this country to hang together. The reason it hangs together was the founding vision of building bridges. So the whole idea was building bridges. Today I find that in the elite of this country, among which I count myself, that idea has lost its traction. You know, it's lost its vigor. For the last 25, 30 years, the elite has been drifting off into a kind of band which seems to imagine that the resources of this country, the lives of the poor of this country, are there in their service. So my class of people, in some sense, has almost abdicated its responsibilities towards the larger idea of India. And that's hugely problematic. You have to understand that the men and women who shaped the idea of India all came from elite backgrounds. Gandhi went to Lincoln's Inn in London. Nehru was born to one of the richest men in India. He went to Harrow. He went to Cambridge. Ambedkar went to Columbia.
I mean, in the States.
So you look at the founding fathers, they all came from great elite backgrounds. All of them turned their back on great privilege to pursue the greater idea for the greater good. I mean, so the foundationally, India is based on the idea of the social contract, that if you have more, you give back to those who have less. There are countries in the world, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter in Scandinavia. I'm sure it doesn't matter in France or England, you know, all these things. But in India, how can it not matter? I mean, I remember Carlos Fuentes once said this. That was in connection with writing. And I'm just going to extrapolate it to say in connection with everybody of the elite. Fuentes once said, when he was asked in an interview, he said that, you know, how can a Latin American writer write without carrying the carcass of his people around? And I believe, how can the elite of this country exist without forgetting the burden and carcass of its people? You're talking about 7, 8. You've been in Delhi. At every traffic light, you will see little children, 4 years old, 6 years old, 7 years old, begging you for a rupee.
Right.
Which fucking crazy country imagines it's a superpower when it can't feed its children, it can't clothe its children, it can't send its children to school? I find this whole discourse of shining India, superpower India, I find it absolutely obnoxious, because vocabulary, what you speak, is what you become. You know, when you speak this kind of nonsense, it's what you become. India was a great... You read the founding fathers even today. I'll pull you volumes of Gandhi and Nehru, and your hair... Look, my hair rises when I talk about these guys. because you read the language, you read their ideas, you read what they're trying to say. Mm. Then you have this kind of utterly idiotic discourse that now you have of shining India just because 50 million or 20 million people are in India doing well, and because we are so many, so more cars are selling and more air conditioners are selling. But it's only a small part of the story. I'm not delegitimizing that story. I think it's a great story. I love that story. But that is not the entire story. The problem is the West wants us to believe that that's the story. I mean, and it all has to do with economic opportunity. It all has to do with business possibilities. I mean, in the 1970s, the West painted us as a land of snake charmers and yogis and fakirs. It suited them. It was the exotic story to tell. Today, the story that suits them is the big, burgeoning middle class, the new markets, the money, the software, the writing, the cinema. I mean, that's all. We made much greater cinema in the last 50 years than something as absurd as the Slumdog Millionaire. Why does Slumdog Millionaire have a ride? Slumdog Millionaire has a ride because India is an economic story. At the end of the day, all culture rides on the coattails of economic efflorescence. It's true of the world. I mean, why did Chinese art become big 30 years ago? Why did Chinese cinema become big 20 years ago? Why did Chinese writing become big 25 years ago? Because China began to emerge as a superpower. So all the kind of noise you hear about India and Indian clothes and Indian couture and Indian food and Indian yoga and Indian, you know, Ayurveda and Indian writers and Indian cinema is fundamentally India's growing economic power. So for 200 years, we were either Francophones or Anglophones because they were the dominant economic powers of the world. So we fucking read Dickens and Emily Bronte and all these characters, you know, and the French. Then the last 100 years, it was the Americans. So we grew up looking at, you know, Mickey Mouse and Donald Duck and all that, which had no meaning. But that was the dominant economic power. So it was culturally the dominant power. Today, we are the emerging economic power in many ways. So the culture becomes that important too. Beyond that, its true worth, I'm not too sure about any of it. Yeah. So it suits the West today to see us in a kind of way. It's the way they want to read us. That's why we are being portrayed. I think places like Tehelka, and not just us, many others, are just trying to raise a flag and say, it's a more complex story. This is only a part of that story. We are not saying the story is not true. There is true, but it's only a small part of a much larger, much more complex story. And it's important to see the whole story.
Tarun Tejpal, I'm thinking of one of your novels I've read, The Alchemy of Desire, in which you go through a series of types through the 20th century. There's the older generation that grows up wanting to be the Brown Sahib, loving the English. Then there's the people who grow up with the Gandhi dream in the 30s, 40s. There are the people who rejoice in the Nehru moment. There's a deeply cynical time around Indira Gandhi. Where are we now? Who's the social type that characterizes 2010 India?
Actually, I mean, I'm going to sound terribly cynical, but I think the dominant metabolism in India and among Indians wealthy has really become one of acquisition and consumption. I mean, we almost seem to be losing that traction on the life of the mind that was always very big, you know, among the elite in this country. I mean, many of our greatest gods are devoted to the idea of learning, you know, Saraswati, or the idea of music, you know. But I think there's been a kind of loss of that. I think we are a country that, after deprivation, after centuries of deprivation, is suddenly finding the kind of, you know, the giddiness of money. And at this moment in time, and I hope it'll pass, at this moment in time, our dominant metabolism is to acquire and consume. There's very little thinking going on. And again, when I say this, I mean my class of people, you know, which in some sense is the elite, which in some sense has its levers on all the handles of money and power and resource. I mean, we are not collectively as a group of people thinking very hard. I think there's very little thought, there's very little thinking. The dominant urge is to acquire and consume by all means, yeah, whichever way we can. And I hope it passes, as I said, that I hope we pass through this phase into something more deeper and meaningful, because I think our challenges are enormous. I think our challenges are not going to be surmounted in the next 20, 30, 40 years. I think we're in for a very long haul, and it would be... On the plus side, I'd say there are some great warriors in India, you know, who do battle every day across the board. You know, people who battle for, you know, equalities, against iniquities, against, you know, for justice.
I want to hear about the trials and the tribulations of an editor who feels that way and who, in every issue of your magazine, is sticking it to people in a certain way.
Well, you know, I mean, here's the good news. The good news, I think, is our trials and tribulations are mostly over. I mean, Telka went through a very, very rough time for many years. We came down from an office of 120 people to just 4 people. We fought for years to resuscitate ourselves, to bring ourselves back. For years, we practiced no journalism. We only fought legal cases and commissions of inquiry. So, I mean, we've had our run.
Who was fighting you?
The last government, you know, the right-wing Hindu government in 2001 when we broke our big story, which against corruption in defense procurements. I mean, they went for us in a highly unconstitutional way. And we were pretty much run into the ground. I mean, there are still cases from that time, dummy cases, fraud cases, which were put against us, for which I go to court even today. You know, I mean, 2 or 3 times a month, I'm in some court or the other for dummy cases. I mean, because in India, these things never end. They'll probably go on till I die. But as I said, the good news is I think the worst is over. I think Telka, against all odds, I mean, I think there was nobody in the world who gave us a ghost of a chance of ever coming back. But we managed to come back in 2004. We managed to set up a weekly. We managed to do about 50 times more work in these last 5 years than we had ever done before. So, I mean, we have a checkered, crazy history. But the nice thing is that what you live and what you do is what shapes you and what makes you, you know. I mean, so I think Telka's character in that sense has been shaped by everything we saw and did. And I have to say that till I ran headlong into the Indian state, I have to say, like most other elite Indians and like almost all Indian journalists, I had an extremely idiotic, shallow, rosy idea of both the state of power of politics and of India. Mm. I think my great and deep understanding of this country has only come in the last 10, 11 years. I mean, we were swallowed by the beast, you know, and that's when we understood what the belly of the beast looks like. Mm. And I think most Indians of my class lead lives of such incredible sanitization, such incredible kind of superficiality, that they have very little idea about what are the true engines that move this country and what's really happening, you know.
Tell us about them.
Well, I mean, you see it all around. I mean, you go to any forum and you see this kind of, you know, glib, idiotic talk about how India's booming and how India's fantastic and India's a great superpower.
Incredible India.
I mean, you keep hearing this stuff, and all you have to stop is ask them a few kind of, you know, questions about around hard facts. You know, one of my favorite questions always is, what's the percentage of Indians under 5, babies, Indian children under 5, who are affected by severe malnutrition? You know, I mean, it's my classic question. Mm. And I give them the China figure. In China, the figure is 5%. 5% of children under 5 years old are affected by severe malnutrition. In India, the figure is 46%.
Mm.
1 out of 2 children suffer severe malnutrition, which with all its fallouts, you know, of intellectual diminishment, physical diminishment, emotional diminishment. I mean, that's the state. When you are, as I told you, you can see it in the capital of this country, which they're trying to sanitize day in and day out for some stupid kind of foreign thing or the other. I mean, every traffic light, you can see little kids begging for rupees, yeah? I mean, how are we so blind to it? What has made my class of people so blind to the injustices of this country? I mean, Telka has done phenomenal work, for example, on the Muslim question. I mean, over 3.5 years ago, we got really deep into the whole Muslim question, and we discovered, to our great dismay, that there is almost a structural bias and prejudice against Muslims in India, you know, in the judiciary, in the police, in the bureaucracy, in the political class, in the middle class. I mean, and it was a very grim thing. But if you ask anybody of my class in India, they will say, we are the most tolerant people in the world, we are the best people in the world, we are the nicest guys, you know, Muslims in India are treated great. But it was not true, we found. And we did, I mean, many of these are cover stories, and actually it's led to a huge change in perception. We nailed down story after story about innocent young Muslim boys being picked up by the security forces just because they were Muslims, you know, and being targeted. And we found that there was a genuine prejudice that had built itself into the system, and it really needed to be combated, you know. And the middle class is full of this kind of easy bias.
Do Telka stories like that get results?
You know, results is, you know, the two things about the whole result business. One is it's impossible to tell in the short run. I'm a great believer in accretion. I mean, it's something I talk to my staff all the time about. Things accrete, you know. I mean, prejudice accretes over time, and the battle against prejudice will also accrete over time, you know. I mean, these all things accrete, excellence accretes over time. I don't think, for example, excellence is an overnight game. I'm always trying to tell my kids, you keep at it, you keep at it, you chip away at it, and you accrete and you arrive somewhere. So I would actually believe that our Muslim stories have had a huge impact on all the work we did. Even more, the work we've done on the whole Naxalite issue. You know, for 2 years, there's the big important cover we did, which we said why we should fear a war against our own people. A year and a half ago, we did a cover story where we said why we should fear a war against our own people. And we tried to set the tone for this discourse. And we still do it every day. I mean, my managing editor, Shoma, has done some fantastic work on it. We always have a reporter on the ground. That's one of the things Tehelka does. We believe in it. There's a story. We put feet on the ground straight away. On the Naxalite question, we've had feet on the ground relentlessly for the last 2 years. One person comes back, next goes in. One editor comes back, next goes in. One reporter comes, next goes in. And because of that, we have been able to argue continuously that the vocabulary of this battle has to change. That these are your own people. These are the wretched of your own land. These are people who have been denied development. These are people who have been pushed to the very brink and have taken up the gun because they've been pushed to the brink. You have to have a different, whether it's at the level of the Prime Minister or at the level of the Home Minister or at the level of media discourse, Tehelka has argued again and again for a far more inclusive and benign approach to the whole problem, arguing basically that these are the wretched of your own land who have been done in by the policies of the state, by the malign arm of the state. And I can tell you that that too has had a huge impact. If Tehelka were to close tomorrow, I'm very sanguine about this place because I always feel it wasn't even meant to exist. Everybody said it can't exist. So we've been here 6 years doing work. If it closes tomorrow, I will go home a happy man and do whatever I have to do just for the work we've done on these two issues, the Muslim question and the Naxalite question. You know, these two narratives, Tehelka has done great work and it's been embedded deeply in those narratives. My problem again about my class of people is if actually you go down the mall, go down to a mall and see the kind of people shopping and the kind of fanciness of the malls, I just think that way too many people of my class are so blank to these contesting ideas around them. They're so blank to the growing battles around them that it's dangerous.
There's a literary side of you and an imaginative side of you. You're a big figure in the cultural imagination of this place. Where do you go, Tarun Tejpal, to touch the pulse of that eternal, reflective, argumentative, combative, thinking, serious, mental India?
You said that right in the beginning yourself, the brilliant, engaged Indian is quite extraordinary, and there are very many of them still around.
Amen.
Yeah, I mean, and in percentage terms, they're too few because we are so many, but there are enough of them around. I told Tina Brown that once. She actually asked me, we were at a forum, and I was talking to her. It was a public forum interview, and at the end of it, she said to me, "Will you be asking me all the questions? I need to ask you one before we close." And she said, "So how do you do it?" So I said, "Do what?" She said, "How do you pull off the Tehelka?" You know, she said, "I would give up my right arm to run a news magazine like this in America." You know, hard investigative and literary. And I said to her, I remember, and it's a line I quote often. I said, you know, the trick is to just, in my cases, I just surround myself with formidable women. You know, and, you know, in my experience, you know, and actually, I mean, in Tehelka itself. I mean, some of the most outstanding journalists we have are all women. The managing editor is a woman. She's done some great work. She's probably the finest writer in Indian journalism. Most of my young reporters are women. Most of the sort of people who helm key positions are women. There's a kind of quality of moral clarity women have that men just don't have, I can tell you that. And courage, too, in my opinion. Because when Tehelka went under and the state was road-rollering me, I mean, the two people who stood by me, I told you, were both women, you know, both are still with this company. So I find both in quality of courage and moral clarity, I think that they're quite fantastic. So, I mean, in this company, I love bright people, I love gifted people, I love people who have ideas and courage. I try and surround myself with them, you know, and in some sense, they keep me going themselves, yeah. And for me, what is still talismanic personally, and I think should be collectively, is the founding idea of India. You know, if you ask me, what is it that I owe allegiance to? Why do I do all this? It's only to the vision of the founding fathers. I think the Indian founding fathers are the most charismatic and a noble group of founding fathers that any country has known, far more than the American or the French. You know, I mean, it's truly a bunch of extraordinary people, yeah. So my allegiance is to that, to the talismanic idea.
You're serious about it. Would you just give us fresh sketches of the men that mean the most to you? Maybe the one that everybody talks about and we in America know least about is Mr. Ambedkar, a Dalit trained at Columbia University in New York. Tell us that story. Tell us the ones that mean the most to you.
Well, for me, when I look at India, for me, the most important is Nehru. I mean, I call myself a Nehruvian. I don't think you would have the India we have today without a man like Nehru existing. The bridge between the Puritanism of Gandhi and the modernism of what was to come. So here was this incredible bridge figure, you know, noble, self-sacrificing, intellectual, you know, charismatic. I mean, so without Nehru, you don't get the India we have. You know, you don't get a secular, liberal, democratic India. You know, you get something else. I still keep saying it's the most extraordinary feat of the imagination to convert a feudal, impoverished, colonized country of nearly 500 years into a modern democratic republic overnight. It's an extraordinary feat. And that's what these guys pulled off. You know, they created a modern nation, and its fruits are still unfurling. Which is why I say everything that you find good about India, and I say this on record, everything that's good and great about India can be directly drawn in a line to the founding vision. You know, everything that's good comes from that founding vision of the founding fathers. The rest is the crap we've loaded on. All the crap is India at its worst, you know. It has nothing to do with the founding vision. The founding vision is truly... So you have a man like Nehru. Let me tell you about Nehru a bit for your listeners. Nehru was born to a man called Motilal Nehru, who was the richest lawyer in India. I mean, he lived in great luxury. He had cars imported from England in Allahabad. The most powerful white men of his time dined on his table. There was silverware, cutlery, you know, crockery coming from England. And there was this boy called Jawaharlal, his only son, Motilal's only son. And he goes off, he sends him off to Harrow to study, and he goes to Cambridge. And then he comes back to India, and this is about 1916, 1917, and he falls under the thrall of Gandhi, who has only returned from South Africa in 1915, but is already beginning to intuit the great, great kind of, you know, subterranean engines that will move this country. And so he falls totally, he's absolutely charmed by Gandhi. And he begins to then start messing around in freedom politics. He has one life-changing experience, Nehru has. He actually ends up spending a night in the hut of a poor villager around 1918 or something. And it tells him two very important things, which are to mark the rest of his life. The first thing it tells him is how unbelievably poor most of India is. You know, the sheer poverty of the peasantry is completely moves him. And the second thing he sees is how much generosity this poor peasantry has. And he's marked by that. Now, here's a guy who's actually grown up in the Anglo tradition. You know, he's almost a Fabian, and that's where the Fabian stuff later marries in with his own vision that comes in here. So he's been to the poshest universities and colleges of the world, and then he comes back and and that's the first time he links up in a soil way that he can only link up with his own country, with his own countrymen, and that's to mark him for the rest of his life. Motilal, in the meantime, finds that his much loved son is slowly drifting away from this great life of luxury and privilege into a kind of dangerous zone of anti-colonial politics. He actually meets Gandhi and asks Gandhi to somehow keep his son away from him. And Gandhi promises him that, because Motilal is an influential man. He's a founder of the Congress Party. So Gandhi assures him that he'll try and keep Jawaharlal away from him. Of course, Jawaharlal is not to be stopped. By 1919, 1920, Jawaharlal is publishing a paper in Allahabad, which is almost on a weekly basis attacking the British rule and the local British guys. It becomes very clear to Motilal, the white man running that place tells his father, because he's a very important man, Motilal, that if he can't rein in his son, they will be forced to arraign him and arrest him. So Motilal by then knows that he can't do anything to his son. So what does Motilal do? It's a great story, you know. Motilal begins to, every night, latch his bedroom door at night. And instead of sleeping in the plush four-poster that he has, he begins to sleep on the floor just to try and get accustomed to the idea of sleeping in a prison cell. And sure enough, within 3 months, Jawaharlal is arrested, And 3 months later, Motilal is arrested, you know. And, you know, very few people know this, that actually Jawaharlal spent more years in prison than even Mahatma Gandhi. Gandhi spent about 9.5 years in prison altogether during the freedom struggle. Jawaharlal spent close to 11 years. These were men born to great privilege, great wealth, you know. But the idea, the larger idea of India that they kind of wrenched out of this, it's just incredible. Look at the story of Ambedkar. Ambedkar is born to a Dalit family, untouchable. His father is a corporal in the army, so he has a little bit of access. If you read Ambedkar's biography, it's heartbreaking, because when he goes to school, he's made to sit separately from everybody else because he's an untouchable. But the bugger is brilliant. The guy is just simply brilliant. He wins scholarship upon scholarship. There's a king of Kolhapur, you know, who's very little sung, unfortunately, because in this country everything is being lost, history is being lost, culture is being lost, everything is being lost. This king of the small principality in Kolhapur spots the boy and funds him for further education and further education. He ends up in fucking Columbia University in the 1920s. You know, he studies at Columbia, he's a genius. He comes back, and who drafts the Constitution of India? You know, one of the great public documents in the world, Ambedkar. And these great men, Nehru has disagreements with Ambedkar, Gandhi has disagreements with Ambedkar, but when it comes to giving the job of helming the constitution to one man, they pick on Ambedkar. And so the constitution we live by is a constitution helmed and written by a boy who was born an untouchable. You know, this great country that we talk about, this constitution has been drafted and written by a boy who was born untouchable, who studied in a school where he was not allowed to sit in the same chair, you know. So, I mean, these are extraordinary stories, yeah, you know. I mean, I'm saying, so that's what I'm saying. So if I don't have religion, so, I mean, I don't do things out of ideas of God and religion. So if I have to look for meaning, you know, if I have to look for reasons for doing what I do, I have to look at what I call talismanic, which is the idea of India as thought of by the founding fathers.
Tarun Tishpal, this is so moving, if I may say. You recoil at the selling of the new India, and yet obviously you believe so profoundly that India's story is the world's story in the 21st century, and that it has to be a crowning example to the vast majority of the world.
I think you put it well, Chris. You put it really well, because I've said that again and again. I think India is actually the crucible of the great world experiment.
If
we fail here, because I mean, here you're trying to actually patch 1,000 fault lines to create some kind of harmony in a society. The whole world is going to be a melting pot. There's no getting away from it. You know, I mean, every city in this world is going to be a melting pot of languages, of ethnicities, of cultures. We already are that. You know, I mean, our success or failure will in some sense be a signal to the world of whether we can succeed as a world or not, you know, because we are that. We are the great melting pot, you know, I mean, we are that. But the only slight difference is, you know, they talk about America as a melting pot very often, but curiously, we often refer to India as a mosaic, you know, instead of a melting pot. That ability that somehow India has had of being together but being a patchwork, castes being separate, you know, communities being separate, classes being separate. I think that patchwork has to learn to be less kind of, you know, corrosive with each other. So, but we are definitely, I mean, it should be India should be the story of the 21st century, but I don't think it'll be the story of the 21st century if my class fails. I think a lot of the success of this country will depend on the success of my class to get outside of the zone of its own self-interest.
I thought you were going to say it can't happen if your class succeeds.
No, I think if my class fails to recognize what it needs to do, and what it needs to do is not just keep creating wealth for itself. What it needs to do is to step a little outside the zone of its own self-interest and see what do we need as a very large and complex society. You know, and so a lot of the success of India is going to depend on the success or failure of my class to recognize its larger role, you know.
Who might do it in India?
It's going to be, again, a process, Chris. I mean, there are many civilizational battles afoot. If you look at even, say, the Naxalite War, the class war, These are all civilizational ideas that are formed. If you look at the right-wing Hindus, the Hindu party of, let's say, the BJP and the right-wing Hindus, who have a more exclusionist idea of India, contesting against the Gandhian idea of India, you know, which is far more inclusionist. So these are all contesting ideas. It's, as I said, Naipaul put it very well in that phrase, A Million Mutinies Now. He wrote a book called A Million Mutinies Now.
Yes.
And that phrase pretty much sums up, because everywhere you look in India, you look at the Northeast, you look at Kashmir, you look at the heart of India, everywhere we seem to be battling. You know, there are fires everywhere. There is a kind of a mismatch of aspirations and delivery. There's a mismatch of justice and expectation everywhere, you know. And so there are battles on everywhere. How these battles will resolve themselves in the long run, I cannot say. What I can say is that we constantly need to craft a vocabulary that allows us to both describe these battles and engage in these battles. And that vocabulary cannot be imperialist. That vocabulary cannot be confrontationist. That vocabulary has to be the old inclusionist vocabulary that was pioneered 100 years ago. And let me give you an example of that, which is a very interesting example. In 1947, India becomes independent, all right? It leads to the formation of two different countries, India and Pakistan. It's all a screw-up. And there is a big, big breakout. There is the worst kind of migration of peoples that the world has ever known, the biggest single migration. Tens of millions of Hindus move to India. Tens of millions of Muslims move out to Pakistan. It's the
thousands killed in the process.
Millions. 600,000. All right, the figure is about a million. So about a million people are killed in the riots that come in this moving and going. But here's the lovely bit. Not a single white man is injured, attacked, or killed. I mean, 300 years later, the Brits are about to leave. A great outbreak of violence takes place. But no white man is targeted. I mean, that's quite extraordinary, you know. So what I'm saying is, there is, because there was a kind of Gandhian discourse and Nehruvian discourse, even in the battles against the colonials, the idea of non-violence, the idea of satyagraha. I mean, they were finely crafted ideas. You know, the imagination was working. I mean, what excites me about the Founding Father is that incredibly febrile imagination that's thinking up new ways beyond the obvious obscenities of violence. I mean, violence is the dumbest idea. It's the simplest and dumbest idea always, you know. But there are far more complex ideas at work, and those guys are doing it. We can't do it anymore. We are imaginatively, we are sterile at this moment. So what we argue for again and again is actually a more imaginative response from the state. The simplest and stupidest state response is always to pull out a gun, you know. But a creative state thinks of other ways of doing things, and that's what we argue for. That's why I said what's going to matter is the vocabulary and the language of our battles in the future.
Think of the creative people. I keep thinking, as you speak, about Amartya Sen saying, in the 50s, when India had so little power, it talked so loud. And in the new century, when it has so much power, its voice is very unclear.
Yeah.
And embodied in a certain way in Manmohan Singh, who doesn't talk at all, as far as we can make out.
Yeah, it's true. It's a problem. I think it's a problem.
Speak of the kinds of writers, statesmen, bureaucrats, anybody from that imaginative realm who you hope would step up and step out. And the world get to know.
There's been a lot of hope of the young boy Rahul Gandhi, and I have to say that though he hasn't said anything that's deeply profound or new, what he has said is things that are well-meaning.
This is the son of Rajiv
Sonia Gandhi. So what he said has been well-meaning, you know, and that itself is a relief, pretty much, you know, all around in a discourse that has become extremely raucous and lowbrow and dishonest, you know. The person who has actually strangely impressed me in the last 10 years is Sonia Gandhi. I find her story extraordinary.
The Italian Indian.
I find it extraordinary, you know, that she's managed to kind of at every juncture do the right thing and avoid stepping into any of the slush. I mean, I think it's quite extraordinary that she's managed to hone her instincts to do that. And for a time, I remember I used to laugh with my political friends that the when the right-wing Hindu BJP was on the ascendant, I used to say that the only person who seems to be fighting the battle for Indian secularism is an Italian, you know. She was the only one who was going around sort of going all in on about the great Indian inclusionist ethos, you know. So, but where will this voice come from? I'm not too sure. Manmohan Singh is basically the kind of the nominee of Sonia Gandhi. He exists because she nominated him to be the prime minister. He's a manager. And I think I wrote this in an assessment of Manmohan Singh after he finished 5 years in as prime minister, that the problem really is that, you know, he has a manner. Managers have a manner. But, you know, leaders have a voice. You know, that's the difference. But, you know, so, I mean, he's a manager. He has a nice manner, you know, sweet manner. But that's what managers have. And that's what he is. But leaders have a voice. Barack Obama is a leader. He has a voice. You know, I mean, so that's what we need is actually leaders who have a voice and the right kind of voice. Where will they come from? When will they come? It's a mystery. It's very difficult to tell. But I hope it happens because we are also a country that's all sorely in need of inspiration. Mm. We are driven by inspiration, you know. I mean, if we have inspirational leadership, we become extraordinary. If we have second and third rate leadership, it's not just true, I'm saying politically, even if you look at companies, if you look at, you know, states, you look at smaller formations, if the number one man is inspirational, the whole collective will be inspirational. But if the whole collective is full of good people, but the number one man is an idiot, it'll be the whole place will be an idiot. So it's, you know, I mean, we are like that. That must be again some remnant of some kind of, you know, old feudal gene. Yeah. So
I'm wondering, what do you need from America? You're going to get a visit from President Obama in November.
Yeah.
But what's America's role in putting India at its best?
You know, the great irony is that the two biggest democracies in the world, instead of having been inordinately close all their lives, have never been. It's an amazing thing. If there was one country in the world America had to pick, which demonstrated the value of free liberal democracies, it would be India. But American foreign policy isn't like that. I mean, they spent their lives cultivating Pakistan because of geopolitical kind of positioning. Now, you all keep hoping that a man like Barack Obama will break through the kind of mesh of geopolitical concerns which have kept, in some sense, official Indian, official America very wary of each other, you know. But to do that, I think you know, Indians, a lot of Indians would have to see that American interests outside of America are not so callous and ruthless as to sink all the principles they hold good inside their own borders, you know. And I think a lot of, at least, the sort of the thinking class doesn't see it that way. The good news for America is that the middle class India loves America, you know. Mm. I mean, we always laugh about it, over the famous poster, Yankee, go home and take me with you, you know. You know, so I mean, middle class India loves America. They love everything American, you know. I mean, it's the great aspirational thing. It's a historic process. I don't know where this historic process will finally throw us up, Chris. As I said, I mean, I just believe in doing battle on the side of the process that I believe in, and so I do battle. But what forces will push this process to where? Mm. I don't know. But were you to ask me what I feel about India today, I would say great distress. For you to ask me, you know, am I very optimistic about India? I would say no. You know, were you to ask me whether you think we will come through, I would say maybe, you know. But I think what we certainly are not is what the world imagines us to be, this great rising, shining superpower, which is just juggernaut spreading ahead, you know. It's much more complex than that. You know, there are some millions of us who are there, among whom I count myself, you know, who have wealth, education, privilege, mobility, you know, power, you know. I mean, we have all that. Is it true of even the remote majority of this country? It's not. 700, 800 million people in this country do not have a story to their lives. I said this to the Prime Minister the one time I met him many years ago. He was very kind to me. He said this was at the end of his first tenure. And he said that one of the endeavors of his own tenure had been to strengthen the hands of people like me. I don't know what that meant, because, I mean, we've never had anything coming our way from this state or any other. But the only thing I remember saying, and I won't take credit for it, but it did happen. I just said that there was a problem with this whole discourse of shining India. I said I thought it was really problematic because it was not true, and it was a great disservice to hundreds of millions who were absolutely being ground down by the processes of this country. There was a big difference in when we became independent. You know, we were about 300 million, 330 million people. And the incredible triumph of the leaders of the time was to weld these 330 million people in one master narrative. Everybody was part of the same master narrative. Everybody was part of the same story. Today, the master narrative has shrapneled completely. There is no master narrative. The only narrative that is on is this, at the time I was talking to him, was this Shining India narrative, which fundamentally concerns maybe 200 million people. But you're still talking about another 900 million to a billion people who are not part of this narrative. We cannot be talking up a narrative all the time that leaves out the majority of your people. You know, so we've actually shrapneled our narrative. Our narrative has been fragmented. And in some sense, I feel for any leadership in India, that is the challenge, to once again find and voice a kind of master narrative that everybody can hold on to, you know. And I think in that Sonia Gandhi has been a good force, because she has in some sense realized, and I remember that in that particular Manmohan Singh piece that I wrote, I said that for now and for the next 50 years, any prime minister of this country has only one constituency to look out for. It's mandated by the founding of this country. It's mandated by our history that there is only one class of people the prime minister has to watch out for, and that's the wretched of this land. I mean, that's his concern has to be nothing else. His concern has to be those 700-800 million people who have no education, who have no fucking food, who have no hope. I mean, that's it. The rest of this country can look after itself. He has to spend far less time bothering about the rich and the wealthy. You know, I mean, they're doing all right. I mean, the prime minister's only concern has to be those who actually pretty much have nothing. Yeah, a country where 50% of its people live less in worse conditions worse than sub-Saharan Africa. I don't understand. You know, I mean, there are more poor people in India than the entire population of Africa. How we manage this sleight of hand of fucking totally creating this other story is bizarre, and that really has to do with what you term as smart India, because there's so many smart Indians around, and you see them all over the world. But in real numbers, they're still a fraction. They're many, but as a percentage of Indians, they're still a small number. It's just that we are so many. When you're 1 billion and 200 million people, I mean, surely there'll be 10 million smart guys around, you know, all of that. And that's the 10, you know, that forget the 10 million. There's that 100,000 that you hear and read about all over the world, you know, among whom are all of us, you know. So it just comes across as a terribly smart country, which doesn't tell you the rest of the story.
Speak for the Indian mind, Tarun Tejpal, about China. Do you see China over your shoulder, out ahead of you? Is it a rival? Is it a challenge? Is it an enemy? Is it a friend? Is it part of the Asian century or what?
Well, see, on most indices, most empirical indices, China would be way ahead of India, and it is. You know, production, you know, wealth generation, all these indices, you know, whether it's child malnutrition or all these. I think the googly, the X factor in this story is the idea of liberty, freedom, and democracy. You know, I mean, freedom brings great torque. It brings great torque. And the torque can be giddying. The torque can be crazy. I think we've lived with that torque for 62 years that freedom brought us, you know. And we've somehow managed to live through that torque and keep being productive and unified. Sooner or later, I think liberty and freedom will come to everybody in China. It's kind of some kind of inevitable historical process. It will happen. What happens when people get the right to say no? When people get to say, right, I will not make one more vuvuzela, or I do not want to manufacture these stupid plastic cups. What happens which in India everybody has. So in India, you know, every damn piece of legislation runs into 3 million protesters. You know, there's somebody to protest about everything. You know, but in spite of that, you kind of go through all that mad thing and you get a consensus and you slowly keep moving on. What happens when that happens in China, when people can just stand up and say, sorry, boss, I don't want to do this. You know, bugger off, I don't want to do this. Then a kind of torque will set in, and that's when the story can shift, you know, if that happens. If say, 10, 15, 20 years later, liberty comes. And the irony here, again, is that we have to agree on certain givens of the human condition. If we have agreed, let's take the Western consensus. If we have agreed that the first great given of the human condition is liberty, all right, then we have to grant that to all peoples everywhere, that liberty is the given condition. Now, if that is the case, and then it will come to the Chinese sooner or later, then it'll be worthwhile seeing, you know, how it pans out, how the torque that is set off by liberty pans out.
What about those other big human truths, equality and fraternity?
I think they all tied into the idea of liberty. I mean, I'm just using liberty as a kind of catch-all word for that. Individualism at the heart of it, which in some sense, as I said, is the kind of Western consensus that liberty is a precondition of the good.
But in India today, on the road, on the train, anywhere, on the street, it's hard to see an ideal of human equality.
That's the struggle here. The struggle here is actually what you said. The struggle here is the scale of inequality. I mean, that's whenever somebody asks me, so what's your biggest problem? I always say inequality. I mean, you're the most unequal country in the world. But if you say liberty, there is the idea of liberty here. You know, I mean, anybody can stand here, I mean, and start abusing the prime minister. You know, you can go down to the road, collect 10 guys and start abusing everybody in the country. You know, if the local cop might come and give you a whack, but it wouldn't have more meaning beyond that. But I'm saying the idea that you're free, you can, anybody can stand here and say, I will not do this. I will not dig this hole. Bugger off. I won't dig this hole. And the Supreme Court will uphold him all the way. Every court will uphold his right to say that. So I'm saying there is the idea of liberty exists, yeah, you know. And it has its, as I said, it. In functional terms, it comes with a huge baggage. We deal with that baggage day on day and have dealt with it for 62 years. The baggage that comes with everybody's ability to say no or yes. In China, it hasn't happened. But I'm assuming that liberty will come sooner or later. It will bring a kind of giddiness and torque. It'll be interesting to see how things pan out once that happens, you know.
Tarun Tejpal, Indian writers rule the world nowadays. Do they rule India? And when you look around for the imaginative resources to get India through this test, do you see writers out there that are making an interesting contribution?
Actually, the whole Indian writer sort of efflorescence is a joke. You know, I mean, this whole business of, you know, Indian writing being this big sort of new, you know, creative force in world literature is a joke. You know, I mean, it just caters to a kind of white commercial publisher's idea of what they want out of India. I mean, the irony is I was at the Turin Book Fair, as I was just telling you earlier, a month ago. And in my session, somebody actually asked me about it, you know, and I said that, let me just tell you that the truth is most of the writers you're talking about or are reading here, they don't even exist for back home in India. I mean, they have zero traction. Nobody who's influential, makes policy, makes a change in this country, even reads them or knows them. I mean, they have no voice. I mean, you'd imagine a great writer in a Latin American country or an East European country would have a great traction. You know, I mean people would wait for his voice and heed his voice and deliberate over his voice. It's not true in India at all. I mean, all these Indian writers in English come from an extremely shallow, superficial space. Most of them are completely unconnected with the deeper engines of India. I mean,
who are you talking about, for example?
I mean, you can name any of them. I'm not going to give names because, unfortunately, I know them all, and they're all friends, and I also know, you know, what they write is a whole lot of rubbish. Yeah, you know, it's all kind
of... But you're not talking about Salman Rushdie or V.S. Naipaul?
No, as I said, I mean, those guys live outside of India. I mean, their reputations have been built over the last many decades. But if Salman Rushdie were to try and tell me something deep about India sitting from where he is, I wouldn't have the time for it, and nobody in India would have the time for it. What I'm saying, they're not part of the discourse or battle of India. You know, great writers are at the heart of their societies. You know, great writers, in a sense, help not just reflect society, but actually help a society build its own self-image.
Sure.
You know, the great writers, the great French writers came at a time when France was trying to understand itself. The great Russian writers came at a time when Russia was trying to find out who they were. And the great American writers, you know, shaped the idea of Americans as themselves. I mean, when societies are in ferment, when societies are making themselves, when societies are trying to understand themselves, which India is doing all of it currently, great writers become a very valuable part of that process. It's not true in India at all. I mean, the only Indian writer...
Are you saying they're not here?
No, they have nothing to do with it. I mean, they have nothing. They don't understand India. They're not connected to India. They have nothing to do. I mean, they're just writing some rubbish for white readers, you know, sitting in some sort of, you know, white towns and cities around the world, yeah. So, I mean, for example, in India, the only writer who writes in English who interests me, even briefly, is Arundhati Roy, because I find she's the only writer who, in some sense, is engaged with the deep, visceral issues of this country and society. I mean, that's the kind of... the rest is advertising copy, you know. I mean, most of what you read and imagine as Indian writers around the world is all junk. Yeah? It's all advertising copy. But it's, unfortunately, that's what the white publisher wants, you know. He wants a certain kind of exoticized idea of India which he can peddle with his readers. And what are the numbers we are talking about? You know, most Indian writers in English sell 3,000, 4,000, 5,000, 6,000 copies. In a country of 1,200,000,000 people, what is the meaning of it? Yeah, you know, I mean,
for what it's worth, can I just want to say, when you speak of this wary relationship between the United States and India over the years, I'm also hearing everywhere in India this deep connection of the transnational countries, these nations beyond nation, the Moby Dick nation, the Pequod nation of 40-plus nations in its crew, and the hero among them really Queequeg, this kind of completely universal character. India and the United States seems to me share some profound and unique...
Well, that Chris, is easy to see. I see where you're getting at. But it's easy to see. You know, you're talking about two very large countries,
yeah.
two countries which are multi in every sense. You know, in the makeup of their peoples, in the makeup of the terrain. You know, I mean, these are two very large countries: seas, mountains, deserts. You know, people of every kind of background, religion of every kind. I mean, the affinities are enormous.
Yeah.
The language, I mean, a lot of the discourse between English and America is conducted around English, so the English language is dominant. Even though English may be one of India's many languages, but at a conservative estimate, there would be 50 to 100 million people speaking English, so that's one-third of America. So I'm saying it could be even more, it could be 150 million. So there's a big sort of, scope for all kinds of affinities. Both are democracies. Both are founded former colonies, you know, both born out of colonialism, both with extraordinary founding fathers, with visions of a great society. So there are great commonalities. Both are practicing democracies, you know, both are in some sense creative countries. So there is a great deal, and today there is a great deal of commerce between India and America because of the sheer exodus, Indian exodus into America. You know, you have 1.5 million Indians living in America today. Many of them doing really well, you know. I mean, making a name for them is all kinds of things. It's an aspirational land for the well of Indian, you know, for the aspirational Indian. You know, so it's very easy to see that, as I keep saying, the irony is that we've been locked into a kind of animus, whereas the affinities are so great, you know. It's strange that the animus has been so much. And I think that animus has to do with official America, probably more than official India, and official America's, and not with real America, because in my experience, I mean, I actually find Americans almost simple. You know, I find them simple. Let me just say it. Indians are the most fucking wily people in the world. You know, I mean, I used to laugh with my American friends earlier on. I said, wait till our businessmen hit the world stage. You guys will be had for breakfast, man. You know, you have no idea what you guys are about, you know. So, I mean, Indians are wily. I mean, we've survived millennia. You have to remember that. We've survived colonialism. We've survived feudalism. You know, we've survived class trouble. We've survived conquerors. We are genetically a very wily people, all right? I mean, we are very cunning, we are very wily. Let me be very clear about that. Americans are almost simple. Americans were gifted a land of milk and honey. You read the American history and you see this incredible land opening up for a small band of people with mineral wealth, oil, land, prosperity, opportunity. I mean, it's a land, you know. I mean, so one can see that the whole American idea of innocence is so strong. It's the Graham Greene book. I don't know if you remember that, The Quiet American.
Very well.
The one set in Vietnam. Yeah, and he's the innocent American, you know. And the point Greene makes somewhere at the heart of the story, which the novel is really about, that innocence after a certain age can be very dangerous. I mean, innocence is nice in a 15-year-old or a 12-year-old, but innocence in a 30-year-old can be very dangerous. So I think America's innocence has been a little dangerous for itself and for everybody else.
You're setting the stage for President Obama's visit to India. What's the definition of victory for India, for America?
I actually expect the visit to go off rather well, because I think he's an extraordinary man. I think he's got a great ability to sort of, you know, speak a language that's both soaring and inclusive, you know. So I expect that he will charm India. I expect that he will charm the chattering and intellectual classes. I think he will say the right things, and I think it will be very easy for him to find a wellsprings in India to which he can connect himself almost seamlessly, which is the wellsprings of Gandhi and Nehru, because a lot of the stuff that he tries to talk about is stuff that has been lived, bled for, sweated for, and articulated by those great men, you know. So I expect it to be a good trip, and I hope it is a good trip. We have hopes of the man.
And his own forebears have sweat and toiled and suffered.
Exactly. So I'm saying it's very easy for him to understand what it's about.
Yeah. Fascinating that he is forgiven, especially by the left in India. Maybe the brown skin has a lot to do with it, but more forgiven in India than he is in America.
For us, there are two things, and I think those two things work for him globally. One was he came in the aftermath of a truly horrible man called George Bush, you know, who was in some sense the target of great derision everywhere. So in that sense, he has really shown in comparison. I mean, it was a time when people really gave a hope from America, and that's tough when you know that the greatest power in the world, in some sense, has now got a kind of malice built into itself, which is obvious from top down. That's problematic for the rest of the world. I think Obama has altered that. So he has shown in comparison in a huge way, you know, coming in the wake of George Bush. And the second thing is, I mean, we must not take away from him, you know, what he has done. You know, he has had failings, and, you know, he has had history on his side and all that. But I think the man, when you read him, is speaking a more refined language than you have found on the global stage in a long time. You know, there has been, I mean, after the great sort of statesmen of the middle of the century, last century, you know, when there were a whole host of outstanding leaders and statesmen, you know, who could speak a refined language, you had a pretty decayed 3-4 decades, yeah, where language itself has decayed, and as George Orwell tells us, you know, it's the first sign of all decay. I mean, language decays, everything decays, yeah, you know. And just the restoration of a finer language, just the restoration of greater refinement in thought and articulation, I think that's a good start. I would love to see that in India.
Tarun Tejpal, you've given us a great short course on India today. You've given me a wonderful vision of the vitality of an independent journalist. I can't thank you enough.
Great, Chris. Thanks for coming. It's good to have you here.
Paul McCarthy and Ben Mandelkern produced and edited this conversation. It isn't over till listeners add their two bits in comments on our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thank you for being part of the conversation.